Even on the rugby pitch, I barely saw him break much of one. But he was sweating now. Too late, mate, I thought. Too fucking late. I think I get it. He was too clever to cut me off at the beginning. The idea for Survive the Night was mine, and we both knew it. If he'd done that, I could have spilled the beans, told everyone about what had happened when we were kids. I didn't have nearly so much to lose as him. So he brought me in, made me feel a part of it. And then he made it look like it was down to someone else that I was chucked out. Not his fault at all. Sorry about that, mate. Such a shame. Would have loved working with you. I remember how much I liked doing the screen test. I felt natural, talking about all that stuff, stuff I knew. I felt like I had something to say, something people would listen to. If they'd asked me to recite my times tables or talk about politics, I would have been fucked. But climbing and abseiling and all that, I taught those skills at the retreat. I didn't even think about the camera after the first bit. The most fucking offensive thing about it is how simple it all must have felt to Will. Stupid Jono. So easy to pull the wool over his eyes. Now I understand why he's been so hard to get hold of recently. Why I felt like he's pushed me away. Why I practically had to beg to be his best man. When he agreed, he must have thought of it as a consolation prize, a sticking plaster. But being best man doesn't pay the bills. It's not a big enough sticking plaster. He's used me the whole time, ever since school. I've been there to do his dirty work for him. But he didn't want to share the spotlight with me. Oh no. When it came to it, he threw me under the bus. I swallow my whiskey in one long gulp. That double-crossing motherfucker. I'll have to find a way to get my own back.
Hannah, the plus one. Olivia is someone else's sister, someone else's daughter. Perhaps I should back off, as Jules told me to. And yet I can't. As the others are streaming into the marquee, I find myself walking in the other direction. Towards the folly. Olivia, I call, once I've stepped inside. There's no answer. My voice is echoed back to me by the stone walls. The folly seems so silent and dark and empty now. It's hard to believe that there's anyone else in here. I know where Olivia's room is, the door that leads off the dining room. I'll try that first, I decide. I knock on the door. Olivia? Yeah? I think I hear a small voice from inside. I take it as my cue to push open the door. Olivia's sitting there on the bed, a towel wrapped around her shoulders. I'm fine, she says, without looking up at me. I'm coming back to the marquee in a minute. I've just got to change first. I'm fine. The second time doesn't make it sound any more convincing. You don't really seem fine, I say. She shrugs but doesn't say anything. Look, I say. I know it's not my business. I know we hardly know each other. But when we talked yesterday, I got the sense that you've been going through some pretty major stuff. I imagine it must be hard to put on a happy face over all that. Olivia remains silent, not looking at me. So, I say, I guess I wanted to ask, what were you doing in the water? Olivia shrugs again. I dunno, she says. A pause. It all got a bit much. The wedding, all the people. Saying I must be so happy for Jules. Asking me how I was doing, about uni. She trails off, looks at her hands. I see how the nails are bitten down as a child's, the cuticles red and raw looking against the pale skin. I just wanted to get away from all of it. Jules had made out that it was all a stunt, that Olivia was being a drama queen. I suspect it was the opposite. I think she was trying to disappear. Can I tell you something? I ask her. She doesn't say no, so I go on. You know how I mentioned my sister Alice last night? Yeah. Well, I suppose you remind me of her a little bit. I hope you don't mind me saying that. I promise it's a compliment. She was the first one in our family to go to university. She got the best GCSEs, straight A's for her A-levels. I'm not all that clever, Olivia mumbles. Yeah? I think you're cleverer than you like to let on. You did English Lit at Exeter. That's a good course, isn't it? She shrugs. Alice wanted to work in politics, I say. She knew that she had to have an impeccable record and to get the right grades for it. She got them, of course. She was accepted into one of the UK's top universities. And then in her first year, after she'd realised that she was easily knocking off firsts for every essay she turned in, she relaxed a bit and got her first boyfriend. We all found it quite funny, me and Mum and Dad, because she was suddenly so into him. Alice told me all about this new guy when she came home for the Christmas holidays. She'd met him at the Reeling Society, which was some posh club she'd joined because they had a fancy ball at the end of term. I remember thinking she brought the same intensity to this new relationship as she brought to her studies. He's dead fit, Han, she told me, and everyone fancies him. I can't believe he'd even look at me. She told me, swearing me to secrecy, that they'd slept together. He was the first boy she'd ever slept with. She told me that she felt so close to him, that she hadn't realised it could be like that. But I remember she qualified this, said it was probably the hormones and all the socio-cultural idealisation of young love. My beautiful, brainy sister, trying to rationalise away her feelings. Classic Alice. But then she started going off him, I tell Olivia. Olivia raises her eyebrows. She got the ick. She seems a bit more engaged now. I think so. By the Easter holiday, she'd stopped talking about him so much. When I asked her, she told me that she realised he wasn't quite the guy she thought he was, and that she'd spent too much time wrapped up in him, that she really needed to get her head down and focus on her studies. She'd got a low 2-1 in an essay she'd handed in, and that had been her wake-up call. Jeez, Olivia says, rolling her eyes. She sounds like a massive geek. And then she catches herself. Sorry. I smile. I told her exactly the same thing. But that was Alice, all over. Anyway, she wanted to make sure that she did the decent thing by him, told him in person. That was Alice all over too. How did he take it? Olivia asks. It didn't go that well, I say. He was pretty horrible about it all. Said he wouldn't let her humiliate him, that she would pay for it. I remember that because I remember wondering what he could possibly do. How do you make someone pay for a breakup? She didn't tell me what he did to get her back, I tell Olivia. She didn't tell me or Mum or Dad. She was too ashamed. But you found out? Later, I say. I found out later. He'd taken this video of her. A video of Alice had been uploaded to the university's intranet. It was a video she had let him take after the fancy Reeling Society ball. It was taken down from the server the second the university found out about it. But by then the news had spread. The damage was done. Other versions of it had been saved on computers around campus. It was posted to Facebook. It was taken down. It was posted again. So, like, revenge porn? Olivia asks. I nod. That's what we'd call it now. But then it was this, you know, more innocent time. Now you're warned to be careful, aren't you? Everyone knows that if you let someone take photos or a video of you, it could end up on the internet. I guess, Olivia says. But people forget. In the moment. Or, you know, if you really like someone and they ask you. So I suppose everyone at uni saw it, right? Yes, I say. But the worst part is, we didn't know at the time. She didn't tell us. She was too ashamed. I think maybe she thought it would spoil our image of her. She'd always been so perfect, though of course that wasn't why we loved her. The fact that she didn't even tell me, that's the part that still hurts so much. Sometimes, I say, I think it's too difficult to tell the people closest to you, the ones you love. Does that sound familiar? Olivia nods. So, I want you to know, you can tell me. Yeah? Because here's the thing. It's always better to get it out in the open, even if it seems shameful, even if you feel like people won't understand. I wish Alice had been able to talk to me about it. I think she might have got some perspective she couldn't see herself. Olivia looks up at me, then away. It comes out as little more than a whisper. Yeah. And then the tinny sound of an announcement comes from the direction of the marquee. Ladies and gents, it's Charlie's voice, I realise. He must be doing his MC bit. Please take your seats for the wedding breakfast. I don't have time to tell Olivia the rest, and perhaps that's for the best. So I don't tell her how the whole thing was like a huge stain upon Alice's life, on her person, like it was tattooed there. None of us had realised quite how fragile Alice was. She had always seemed so capable, so in control, getting all those amazing grades, playing on the sports teams, getting her place at university, never missing a trick. But underneath that, fueling all this success, was a tangled mass of anxiety that none of us saw until it was too late. She couldn't cope with the shame of it all. She realised she would never, could never, work in politics as she had dreamed. It wasn't just that she didn't have her BA, because she dropped out. There was a video of her giving some guy a blowjob, and more, on the internet now. It was indelible. So I didn't tell Olivia how one June, 2 months after she came home from uni, Alice took a cocktail of painkillers and pretty much anything else she could find from the medicine cabinet in the bathroom while my mum was collecting me from netball practice. How, 17 years ago this month, my beautiful, clever sister killed herself.
Aoife, the wedding planner. It's my fault, what just happened with the bridesmaid. I should have seen it coming. I did see it coming. I knew there was trouble brewing with that girl. I knew it when I gave her breakfast this morning. She held it together during the ceremony, even though she looked like she wanted to turn and bolt out of there. Afterwards, of course, I tried to keep my eye on her. But there have been so many other demands on me. The guests were so insistent, so rabid, that the waiting staff, all mostly older school kids and students on their summer holidays, could hardly cope. The next thing I knew, there was the commotion and she was in the water. Seeing her, I was suddenly transported back to a different day, powerless to help, having seen the signs but ignoring them until it was too late. Those insistent images in my dreams, the water rising, my hands reaching out as though I might be able to do something. This time, rescue was possible. I think of the groom walking out of the water with her, saviour of the day. But maybe I could have prevented it from happening at all if I'd paid more attention at the right time. I'm angry with myself for having been so lax. I managed to keep a veneer of cool professionalism in front of the guests for the time it took to marshal them all into the marquee for the wedding breakfast. Even if I hadn't kept such a firm hold of myself, I doubt anyone would have noticed anything was amiss. After all, it is my job to be invisible. I need Freddy. Freddy always makes me feel better. I find him out of sight of the guests in the catering area of the back of the marquee, plating up with a small army of helpers. I get him to step outside with me, away from the curious gaze of his kitchen aides. The girl could have drowned out there, I say. When I think about it, I can hardly breathe. I'm seeing it all, how it could have happened, playing out before my eyes. It is as though I've been transported back to a different day, when there was no happy ending. Oh God, Freddy, she could have drowned. I wasn't paying enough attention. It is the past all over again. All my fault. Aoife, he says. He takes a firm hold of my shoulders. She didn't drown. It's all okay. No, I say. He saved her. But what if? No what ifs. The guests are in the marquee now. Everything is going to go perfectly, trust me. Go back out there and do what you do best.
Freddy has always been good at soothing me.
It's a minor blip. Otherwise, everything is going beautifully.
But it's all different to how I imagined. I say. Harder having them all here, wandering about all over the place. Those men, with their horrible games last night. And now this. Bringing it all back.
It's nearly done, Freddy says firmly. All you have to do is get through the next few hours.
I nod. He's right. And I know I need to get a grip of myself. I can't afford to fall apart. Not today.
Now, the wedding night. Now they can make him out, the man, Freddy, hurrying toward them as quickly as he is able. He holds a torch in his hand, nothing more sinister than that. The light of their own torches picks out the sheen of sweat on his pale forehead as he draws near.
You should come back to the Marquis,
he shouts, between gasps of breath.
We've called the Guardi.
What? Why?
The waitress has come round a little. She says she thinks she saw someone else out there, in the dark. We should listen to him,
Angus shouts to the others once Freddy has left them.
Wait for the police. It's not safe.
Nah,
Femi shouts.
We've come too far.
You really think they're going to be here soon, do you, Angus?
Duncan asks.
The police? In this weather? No fucking way, mate. We're all alone out here.
Well, all the more reason. It's not safe. Are we jumping to conclusions?
Femi shouts.
What do you mean?
He only said she might have seen someone.
But if she did,
Angus calls.
That means
what?
Well, if someone else was involved, it means it might not have been an accident.
He doesn't go so far as to spell it out, but they hear it all the same behind his words. Murder. They grip their torches a little tighter.
These would make good weapons,
Duncan shouts,
if it comes down to it. Yep,
Femi shouts, straightening his shoulders a little.
It's us against them. Four of us, one of them.
Wait, has anyone seen Pete?
Angus says suddenly.
What? Shit, no. Maybe he went with that Freddy bloke.
He didn't, Fem,
Angus replies.
And he was really out of it. Shit!
They call for him.
Pete! Pete, mate! You out there?
There is no answer.
Christ! Well, I'm not going to wander around looking for him, too,
Duncan shouts, a faint but telling tremor in his voice.
It's not the first time he's been in that state, is it? He can look after himself. He'll be fine.
The others suspect he's made an effort to sound more certain than he really is, but they aren't going to question it. They want to believe it too.
Earlier that day, Jules, the bride. Inside the Marquis, Aoife has conjured something magical. It's warm in here, a respite from the increasingly cool wind outside. Through the entrance, I can see the lighted torches flicker and dip, and every so often the roof of the Marquis billows and deflates gently, flexing against the wind outside. But in a way, it only adds to the sense of cosiness inside. The whole place is centred by the candles, and the faces clustered about the candlelight appear rosy, flushed with health and youth. Even if the true cause is an afternoon of drinking in the penetrating Irish wind. It's everything I could have wanted. I look around at the guests and see it in their faces, the awe at their surroundings. And yet, why am I left feeling so hollow? Everyone already seems to have forgotten about Olivia's crazy stunt. It could have happened on another day entirely. They are throwing back the wine, guzzling it down, growing increasingly loud and animated. The atmosphere of the day has been recaptured and is following its prescribed track. But I can't forget. When I think about Olivia's expression, about that pleading look in her eyes when she tried to speak, all the little hairs on the back of my neck prickle to attention. The plates are cleared away, every one practically licked clean. Alcohol has given the guests a real hunger, and Freddie is a great talent. I've been to so many weddings where I've had to force down mouthfuls of rubbery chicken breast, school canteen-style vegetables. This was the most tender rack of lamb, velvet on the tongue, crushed potatoes scented with rosemary. It was perfect. It's time for the speeches. The waiters fan out about the room, carrying trays of Bollinger, ready for toasts. There's a sourness in the pit of my stomach, and the thought of yet more champagne makes me feel slightly queasy. I've drunk too much already. In an effort to match the bonhomie of my guests, and feel strange, untethered. The image of that dark cloud on the horizon during the reception drinks keeps playing upon my mind. There's the sound of a spoon on a glass. Ding, ding, ding. The chatter in the marquee subsides, replaced by an obedient hush. I feel the attention of the room shift. Faces swivel towards us, to the top table. The show is about to begin. I rearrange my expression into one of joyful anticipation. Then the lights in the marquee shiver, going out. We are plunged into a twilight gloom that matches the fading light outside. Apologies, calls Aoife from the back of the marquee. It's the wind outside. The electricity's a bit temperamental here. Someone, one of the ushers, I think, lets out a long, lupine howl, and then others join in, until it sounds as though there is a whole pack of wolves in here. They're all drunk by now, all getting looser and more wild. I want to scream at them all to shut up. Will, I hiss, can we ask them to stop? It'll only encourage them, he says soothingly. His hand closes over mine. I'm sure the lights will come on again in a second. Just when I think I can't bear it any longer, that I really will scream, the lights flicker on again. The guests cheer. Dad stands first to give his speech. Perhaps I should have banished him at the last minute as a punishment for his earlier behaviour. But that would look odd, wouldn't it? And so much of this whole wedding business, I have realised, is about how things appear. As long as we can make it through with all seeming joyful, jubilant, well, perhaps then we can suppress any darker forces stirring beneath the surface of the day. I bet most people would guess that this wedding is all down to my dad's generosity. Not quite. Everyone's been asking me what made me decide to hold the wedding here. I put a shout out on social media. Pitch me your wedding venue. All part of a feature for the download. Aoife answered the call. I admired the level of planning in her pitch, the consideration of practicalities. She seemed so much hungrier than all the rest. It knocked spots off the competition, really. But that's not why this place won our business. The whole unvarnished truth of why I decided to hold my wedding here was because it was nice and cheap. Because Daddy Dearest, standing up there looking all proud, turned off the tap. Or Severine did it for him. No one's going to guess that one, are they? Not when I've got a cake that costs $3,000, or solid silver engraved napkin rings, or Clune Keen Atelier's entire year's output of candles. But those were exactly the sort of things my guests expected from me, and I could only afford them, and a wedding in the style to which I am accustomed, because Aoife also offered a 50% discount if I held it here. She might look dowdy, but she's savvy. That's how she clinched it. She knows I'll feature it in the magazine now, knows it'll get press because of Will. It'll pay dividends in the end. I'm honoured to be here, Dad says now, at the wedding of my little girl. His little girl. Really? I feel my smile harden. Dad raises aloft his glass. He's drinking Guinness, I see. He's always made a point of not drinking champagne, keeping true to his roots. I know that I should be gazing back adoringly, but I'm still so cross about what he said earlier that I can barely bring myself to look at him. But then, Julia has never really been my little girl, Dad says. His accent is the strongest I've heard it in years. It always gets more pronounced at times of heightened emotion, or when he's had a fair amount to drink. She's always known her own mind, even at the age of 9. Always knew exactly what she wanted. Even if I... He gives a meaningful cough. Tried to persuade her otherwise. There's a ripple of amusement from the guests. She went after whatever she wanted with a single-minded ambition. He smiles ruefully. If I were to flatter myself, I might try to say that she takes after me in that respect. But I'm not the same. I'm not nearly so strong. I pretend to know what I want, but really it's whatever has taken my fancy. Jules is absolutely her own person, and woe betide anyone who gets in her way. I'm sure any employers of hers will agree. There's some slightly nervous laughter from the table of the download crowd. I smile at them, beatifically. None of you are going to get in trouble. Not today. Look, Dad says. Sure, I'm not the best role model for this wedding stuff, I'll be totally honest. I believe I have wife number 1 and number 5 here this evening. So I suppose you could say I'm a card-carrying member of the club, though not a very good one. Not very funny, though there are some dutiful titters from the spectators. Jules was, quick to point that out to me earlier today, when I attempted to offer some words of fatherly advice. Fatherly advice. Huh. But I would say that I've learned a thing or two over the years about how to get it right. Marriage is about finding that person you know best in the world. Not how they take their coffee or what their favourite film is or the name of their first cat. It's knowing on a deeper level. It's knowing their soul. He grins at Severine, who positively preens. Besides, I hardly felt qualified to give that advice. I know I haven't always been around. Scratch that. I have hardly ever been around. Neither of us have been. I think Amarinta will probably agree with me on that. Wow. I look towards Mum. She wears a Richter smile that I think might well be as taut as my own. She won't have enjoyed the first wife bit because it'll make her feel old and she'll be livid at the suggestion of parental neglectfulness, considering how much she's been enjoying playing the gracious mother of the bride today. So in our absence, Julia has always had to forge her own path. And what a path she has forged. I know I haven't always been very good at showing it, but I am so proud of you, Juju, of all that you have achieved. I think of the school prize-giving ceremony, my graduation, the launch for the download, none of which my father attended. I think about how often I have wanted to hear those words, and now, here they are, right when I'm most furious at him. I feel my eyes fill with tears. Shit, that really caught me unawares. I never cry. Dad turns to me. I love you so much. Clever, complicated, fierce daughter of mine. Oh God, they aren't pretty tears either. A subtle glistening of the eyes. They spill over onto my cheeks and I have to put up the heel of a hand, then my napkin, to try and staunch them. What is happening to me. And here's the thing, Dad says to the crowd. Even though Jules is this incredible, independent person, I like to flatter myself that she is my little girl. Because there are certain emotions, as a parent, that you can't escape. No matter what a shite one you've been, no matter how little right you have to them. And one of those is the instinct to protect. He turns to me again. I have to look at him now. He wears an expression of genuine tenderness. My chest hurts. And then he turns to Will. William, you seem like a great guy. Was it just me, or was there a dangerous emphasis on the seam? But, Dad grins. I know that grin. It isn't a smile at all. It's a baring of teeth. You better look after my daughter. You better not feck this up. And if you do anything to hurt my girl, well, it's simple. He raises his glass in a silent toast. I'll come for you. There's a strained silence. I force out a laugh, though it seems to come out more like a sob. There's a ripple in its wake, other guests following suit. Relieved, perhaps, to know how to take it. Ah, it's a joke. Only it wasn't a joke. I know it. Dad knows it. And I suspect, from the look on Will's face, he knows it too.
Olivia, the bridesmaid. Jules's dad sits down. Jules looks a wreck, her face blotchy and red. I saw her dabbing her eyes with her napkin. She does feel stuff, my half-sister, even if she does a good impression of being so tough all the time. I feel bad about earlier, honestly. I know Jules wouldn't believe it if I told her, but I am sorry. I still feel cold, like the chill from the sea got deep under my skin. I've changed into the dress I wore last night because I thought that would piss Jules off the least, but I wish I could have got into my normal clothes. I'm keeping my arms wrapped around myself to try and stay warm, but it doesn't stop my teeth chattering together. Will gets to his feet to hollers and whistles, a few catcalls. Then the room falls silent. He has their total attention. He has that sort of effect on people. I guess it's how he looks and how he is, his confidence, how he's always totally in control. "On behalf of my new wife and I," he says, and is almost drowned out by the whoops and cheers, the drumming on the tables, the stamping of feet. He smiles around until everyone settles down. "On behalf of my new wife and I, thank you so much for coming today," he says. "I know Jules will agree with me when I say that it is a wonderful thing to celebrate with all of our most cherished loved ones, our nearest and dearest." He turns to Jules. "I feel like the luckiest man in the world." Jules has dried her eyes now, and when she looks up at Will, her expression is totally different, transformed. She seems suddenly happy enough that it is hard to look at her, like staring at a light bulb. Will beams back at her. "Oh my God," I hear a woman whisper at the next table. "They're just too perfect." Will's grinning around at everyone. "And it really was luck," he says. "Our first meeting. If I hadn't been in the right place at the right time, as Jules likes to say, it was our sliding doors moment." He raises his glass. "So, to luck, and to making your own luck, or giving it a little helping hand when it needs it." He winks. The guests laugh. "First of all," he says, "it's customary to tell the bridesmaids how beautiful they're looking, isn't it? We only have one, but I think you'll all agree she's beautiful enough for seven. So a toast to Olivia, my new sister." The whole room turns towards me, raising their glasses. I can't bear it. I look at the floor until the cheers die down and Will begins to speak again. "And next to my new wife, my beautiful, clever Jules. The guests go wild again. Without you, life would be very dull indeed. Without you, there would be no joy, no love. You are my equal, my counterpart. So please, be upstanding to raise a toast to Jules. The guests all rise to their feet around me. To Jules, they echo, grinning. They're all smiling at Will, the women especially, their eyes not leaving his face. I know what they're seeing. Will Slater, TV star, husband now to my half-sister. Hero. Look how he rescued me earlier from the water, all-round good guy. Do you know how Jules and I met? Will asks, when they've all sat down. It was the work of fate. She threw a party at the V&A Museum for the download. I was just a plus one. I had come along with a friend. Anyway, my friend had to leave the party and I was left behind. I was just deciding whether to leave myself. So it was a total spur-of-the-moment decision to go back inside. So who knows what would have happened if I hadn't? Would we ever have met? So even though Jules works so hard that I sometimes feel it's the third person in our relationship, I'd also like to thank it for bringing us together. To the download. The guests get to their feet. To the download, they parrot. I didn't meet Jules's new fiancé until after they were engaged. She had been very hush-hush about him. It was like she hadn't wanted to bring him home before she got the ring on her finger in case we put him off. Maybe I sound like a bitch for saying that, but Jules has always been pretty ruthless about some things. I suppose I don't blame her exactly. Mum can be a bit much. Jules being Jules, she'd stage-managed the whole thing. They were going to arrive at Mum's for coffee, stay for half an hour, then we'd all head off to the River Cafe for lunch, their favourite place, Jules told us. She had booked. Her instructions to Mum and me were pretty clear. Do not fuck this up for me. I honestly didn't mean to fuck it up. That first meeting with Jules' fiancé. But when the two of them arrived, and they first walked in through the door, I had to run to the bathroom and throw up. Then I found I couldn't move. I sank down next to the loo and sat on the floor for what felt like a very long time. I felt winded, like someone had punched me in the stomach. I saw exactly how it had happened. He'd gone back into the V&A after he put me in that taxi. There he'd met my sister, Belle of the Ball, so much better suited to him. Fate. And I remember what he'd said when we first met. If you were 10 years older, you'd be my ideal woman. I saw it all. After a little while, because she had her important schedule, I suppose, Jules came upstairs. Olivia, she said, we need to go off for lunch now. Of course, I'd love you to join us, but if you're not feeling well enough, then, well, I suppose that's fine. I could hear that it wasn't fine, not at all, but that was the least of my worries. Somehow I managed to find my voice. I can't come, I said through the door. I'm ill. It seemed the easiest thing to do right then, to go along with what she'd said. And anyway, I wasn't feeling well. I was sick to my stomach, like I'd swallowed something poisonous. I've thought about it since, though. What if right then I'd had the balls to open that door and tell her the truth, right then and there to her face, rather than waiting and hiding until it was way too late? Okay, she said. Fine then. I'm very sorry you can't come. She didn't sound in the least bit sorry. I'm not going to make a big deal out of this now, Olivia. Maybe you really are ill. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. But I'd really like your support in this. Mum told me you've had a rough time lately and I'm sorry for that. But for once, I'd like you to try and be happy for me. I slumped down against the bathroom door and tried to keep breathing. He covered it so quickly, his own reaction. When he walked in through Mum's door, that first time we met, there was maybe a split second of shock, one that maybe only I would have noticed. The flicker of an eyelid, a slight tightening of the jaw, nothing more than that. He covered it up so well, he was so smooth. So you see, I can't think of him as Will. To me, he'll always be Stephen. I hadn't thought of that when I renamed myself for the dating app. I hadn't thought that he might have lied too. At their engagement drinks, I decided I wouldn't run away and hide like before. I'd spent the couple of months in between thinking of all the ways I could have reacted that would have been so much better, so much less pathetic than scarpering and throwing up. I hadn't done anything wrong, after all. This time, I'd confront him. He was the one that had all the explaining to do, to me, to Jules. He was the one who should be feeling pretty fucking sick. I had let him win that first one. This time, I was going to show him. He threw me off at the beginning. When I arrived, he gave me a big grin. "Olivia," he said, "I hope you're feeling better. It was such a shame we didn't get to meet properly last time." I was so shocked I couldn't say anything. He was pretending we'd never met, right to my face. It made me even start to doubt myself. Was it really him? But I knew it was. There was no doubt about it. Closer up, I could see how the skin around his eyes creased the same, how he had these two moles on his neck, below the jaw. And I remembered so clearly that split second's reaction when he'd first seen me. He knew exactly what he was doing, making it harder for me to get my own version of the truth out. And he'd also banked on me being too pathetic to say anything to Jules, too scared that she wouldn't believe anything I said. He was right.
Hannah, the plus one. There was something weird about Will's speech just now. Something that felt strangely familiar. A sense of déjà vu. I can't quite put my finger on it, but while everyone around me cheered and clapped, I was left with an uneasy feeling in the pit of my stomach. "Here we go," I hear someone at the table whisper. "Is everyone ready for the main event?" Charlie's not on my table. He's on the top table, right there at Jules's left elbow. It makes sense, I suppose. I'm not one of the wedding party after all, while Charlie is. But everywhere else, husbands and wives seem to be seated next to one another. It occurs to me that I have barely seen Charlie since this morning, and then only outside at the drinks, which somehow made me feel more disconnected from him than if we hadn't seen one another at all. In the space of a mere 24 hours, it feels as though a gulf has opened up between us. The guests sitting near me have done a poll on how long the best man's speech is going to last. 50 quid for a bet, so I declined. They've also designated our table the naughty table. There's a manic, intense feeling around it. They're like children who have been cooped up for too long. Over the last hour or so, they've knocked back at least a bottle and a half each. Peter Ramsey, who's sitting on the other side of me, has been speaking so quickly that it's starting to make me feel dizzy. This might have something to do with the crusting of white powder around one of his nostrils. It's everything I can do not to lean over and dash it off with the corner of my napkin. Charlie rises to his feet, resuming his MC role, taking the mic from Will. I find myself watching him carefully for any sign that he might have had too much to drink. Is his face drooping slightly in that telltale way? Is he a little unsteady on his feet? "And now," he says, but there's a scream of feedback as people, especially the ushers, I notice, groan and jeer and cover their ears. Charlie flushes. I cringe inwardly for him. He tries again. "And now, it's time for the best man. Everyone give a big hand for Jonathan Briggs."
"Be kind, Jono,"
Will shouts, hands cupped around his mouth. He gives a wry smile, a pantomime wince. Everyone laughs. I always find the best man's speech hard to watch. There's so much expectation. There's that tiny, hair-thin line between being too vanilla and causing offence. Better, surely, to stay on the PC side of it than to try and nail it completely. I get the impression Jono's not the sort to worry about offending anyone. Maybe I'm imagining it, but he seems to be swaying slightly as he takes the mic from Charlie. Beside him, my husband looks sober as a judge. Then, as Jono makes his way around to the front of the table, he trips and nearly falls. There's lots of heckling and catcalling from my table companions, whoops and catcalls. Next to me, Peter Ramsey puts his fingers in his mouth and lets out a whistle that leaves my eardrums ringing. By the time Jono gets out in front of us all, it's pretty clear he's drunk. He stands there silently for several seconds before he seems to remember where he is and what he's meant to be doing. He taps the mic a few times and the sound booms around the tent.
Come on, Jonas, someone shouts. We're growing old waiting here.
The guests around my table start drumming with their fists, stamping with their feet.
Speech, 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 speech.
The hairs on my arms prickle. It's a reminder of last night, that tribal rhythm, that sense of menace. Jono does a calm down motion with his hand. He grins at us all. Then he turns and looks towards Will. He clears his throat, takes a deep breath.
We go a long way back, this fella and I. Shout out to all my old Trevelyans.
A cheer goes up, particularly from the ushers. Anyway, Jono says as the sound dies down, sweeping a hand to indicate Will. Look at this guy. It would be easy to hate him, wouldn't it?
There's a pause, a beat too long, maybe, before he picks up again.
He's got everything. The looks, the charm, the career, the money.
Was that pointed?
And, he gestures to Jules, the girl. So actually, now I think about it, I suppose I do hate him. Anyone else with me?
A ripple of laughter goes around the room. Someone shouts,
hear, hear.
Jono grins. There's this wild, dangerous glitter in his eyes.
For those of you who don't know, Will and I were at school together. But it wasn't any normal school. It was more like, oh, I don't know, a prison camp crossed with the Lord of the Flies. Thanks for giving us that one last night, Charlie boy.
See, it wasn't about getting the best grades you could. It was all about survival. I wonder if I imagined the emphasis on the last word, spoken as though it were a proper noun. I remember the game they told us about at dinner last night. That was called survival, wasn't it?
And let me tell you, Jono goes on, we have got into our fair share of shit over the years. I'm talking about the Trevelyans' days in particular. There were some dark times. There were some mental times. Sometimes it felt like it was us versus the rest of the world. He looks over at Will. Didn't it?
Will nods, smiles. There's something a bit strange about Jono's tone. There's a dangerous edge, a sense that he could do or say anything and take it all completely off the rails. I look around the other tables. I wonder if the other guests are sensing it too. The room has certainly gone a little quiet, as though everyone is holding their breath.
That's the thing about a best mate, isn't it?
Jono says.
They've always got your back.
I feel like I'm watching a glass teeter on the edge of a table, unable to do anything about it, waiting for it to shatter. I glance over at Jules and wince. Her mouth is set in a grim line. She looks as though she's waiting for this to all be over.
And look at this, Jono gestures to himself. I'm a fat fucking slob in a too tight suit. Oh, he turns to Will. You know how I said I'd forgotten my suit? Yeah, there's a little story behind that one.
He swivels round to face us, the audience.
So, here's the truth, the honest truth. There was never any suit. Or there was a suit, then there wasn't. See, at the beginning, I thought Will might get it for me. I don't know much about these things, but I'm pretty sure that happens with bridesmaids' dresses, doesn't it?
He looks inquiringly at us all. No one answers. There's a hush in the marquee now. Even Peter Ramsey next to me has stopped jiggling his leg up and down.
Doesn't the bride buy them?
Jono asks us.
It's the rule, isn't it? You're making someone wear the fucking thing. It's not like it's their choice. An old Will here especially wanted me to have a suit from Paul Smith. Nothing less would do.
He's getting into the swing of things now. He's striding back and forth in front of us like a comedian at an open mic night.
Anyway, so we're standing in the shop and I see the label and I think to myself, bloody hell, he's being generous. 800 quid. It's the sort of suit that gets you laid, right? But for 800 quid. Better to pay to get laid. Like, what use do I have in my life for an 800 quid suit? It's not exactly like I've got some fancy do to attend every couple of weeks. Still, I thought, if that's what he wants me to wear, who am I to argue?
I glance towards Will. He's smiling, but there's a strained look to it. But then, Jono says, there's this awkward moment by the till, when he sort of stands aside and lets me get on with it. I spend the whole time praying it goes through on my credit card. Total fucking miracle it did, to be perfectly honest. And he stands there, smiling the whole time. Like he'd really bought it for me. Like I should turn round and thank him. Shit's just got real, Peter Ramsey whispers. So the next day, I returned the suit. Obviously, I wasn't going to tell Will all this. So you see, I concocted this whole plan, way before I got here, that I pretended I'd left it at home. They couldn't make me go all the way back to Blighty to get it, could they? And thank Christ I live in the middle of nowhere so that none of you lot could kindly offer to go and get it for me, as that would have landed me in hot water. Is this meant to be funny? A woman across from me asks. 800 quid for a suit, Jono says. 800. Because it's got some random bloke's name stitched inside the jacket. I'd have had to sell a fucking kidney. I'd have had to sell this shit. He runs his hands down his body, lasciviously, to a few half-hearted catcalls. On the street. And you know there's only limited interest in fat, hairy slobs in their mid-30s. He gives a big, wild roar of a laugh. Following suit, like they've been given their cue, some of the audience laugh with him. Their laughs of relief, like the laughs of people who have been holding their breath. I mean, Jono says, not done. He could have bought me the suit, couldn't he? It's not like he's not loaded, is it? Mainly thanks to you, Jules, love. But he's a stingy bastard. I say that, of course, with all my love. He pretends to flutter his eyelashes at Will in a weird camp parody. Will's not smiling anymore. I can't even bring myself to look at Jules's expression. I feel like I shouldn't watch. This is not all that different to that horrible, dark compulsion you have to look at the scene of a car crash. Anyway, Jono says, whatever. He lent me his spare, no questions asked. That's stand-up bloke behaviour, isn't it? Though I have to warn you, mate, he stretches, and the jacket strains against the button holding it closed. It may never be the same again. He turns to face all of us again. But that's the thing about a best mate, isn't it? They've always got your back. He might be a tightwad, but I know he's always been there for me. He puts a big hand on Will's shoulder. Will looks as though he's slightly buckling under the weight, as though Jono might be putting some downward pressure on it. And I know, I truly know, that he would never screw me over. He turns to Will, dips in close as though he's searching Will's face. Would you? Mate. Will puts up a hand and wipes his face where it seems Jono's saliva has landed. There's a pause, an awkward, lengthening pause, during which it becomes clear that Jono's actually waiting for an answer. Finally, Will says, no, I wouldn't. Of course I wouldn't. Well, that's good, Jono says. That's great, because the things we've been through together, the things I know about you, man, it wouldn't be wise, would it? All that history we share together, you remember it, don't you? All those years ago. He turns back to Will again. Will's face has gone white. What the fuck? Someone on the table whispers. Is Jono going on about? Is he on something? I know, I hear in reply. This is mental. And you know what? Jono says. I had a little chat with the ushers earlier. We thought it might be nice to bring a bit of tradition to proceedings. For old time's sake. He gestures to the room. Chaps? As if on cue, the ushers rise. They all move to surround Will, where he's sitting. Will shrugs, good-humouredly. What can you do? Everyone laughs, but I see that Will's not smiling. Seems only fair, Jono says. Tradition and all that. Come on, mate, it'll be fun. And between them, they grab hold of Will. They're all laughing and cheering. If they weren't, it would appear a whole lot more sinister. Jono has taken his tie off and he wraps it around Will's eyes, tying it, like a blindfold. Then they hoist him up on their shoulders and march off with him. Out of the marquee. Into the growing darkness.
Jono, the best man. We drop Will on the floor of the Whispering Cave. I guess he won't be delighted about his precious suit touching the wet sand, or the fact that the smell in here hits you like a punch in the face, rotting seaweed and sulphur. It's starting to get darker and you have to squint a bit to see properly. The sea's rougher than it was earlier too. You can hear it crashing against the rocks on either side. The whole way here, as we carried him, Will was laughing and joking with us. You boys better not be taking me anywhere messy. If I get anything on this suit, Jules will kill me. And can't I bribe any of you with an extra crate of bolly to take me back? The guys are all laughing. For them, this is all great fun. A bit of a blast from the past. They've been sitting in the marquee for a couple of hours getting drunker and more restless, especially those like Peter Ramsay who have powdered their noses. Before I did my speech, I too had a bump in the toilets with some of the blokes, which was maybe a bad idea. It's only made me more jittery. It's also made everything weirdly clear. The others are all just excited to be outside. It's a bit like the stag, all the boys together like it was back in the day. The wind blowing a gale now makes it all the more dramatic. We had to bend our heads low against it. It made carrying Will all that much harder. It's a good spot here, the Whispering Cave. Pretty out of the way. You can imagine, if there had been a cave like this at Trevelyan's, it would have been used in survival. Will is lying on the shingle, not too close to the water. Don't know what the tides are like around here. We bound his wrists and ankles with our ties, as per old-school tradition. All right, boys, I say. Let's leave him here for a bit, see if he can make his own way back.
We're not going to actually leave him there, are we? Duncan whispers to me as we climb out of the cave. Until he works out how to untie himself.
Nah, I tell him. Well, if he hasn't returned in half an hour, we'll come get him.
You better, Will calls. He's still acting like this is all a big joke. I've got a wedding to get to.
I head towards the marquee with the rest of the ushers. Know what? I say as we pass the folly. I'm going to peel off here, got to take a leak. I watch them all return to the marquee, laughing and jostling each other. I wish I could be like one of them. I wish for me it was only harmless school memories, a bit of fun, that it could still be a game. When they're all out of sight, I turn around and start walking back to the cave.
Who's that? Will calls as I approach him. His words echo in the space, so it sounds as though there are five of him saying it.
It's me, I say. Mate.
Jono, Will hisses. He's managed to sit up. He's leaning against the cave wall.
Now the boys have gone, he's dropped the act. Even with his eyes covered, I can see he's fairly pissed off, his jaw tight.
Untie me. Get this blindfold off. I should be at the wedding. Jules will be livid. You've had your joke now, but this isn't funny.
No, I say. No, I know it's not. See? I'm not laughing either. It's not that much fun when you're on the other end of it, is it?
But you wouldn't know. Not up until now. You never did a survival, did you, at Trev's? Somehow got out of that one too.
I see him frown behind the blindfold.
You know, Jono, he says, his tone light, friendly. That speech and now this. I think you might have had a bit too much of the good stuff. Seriously, mate, I'm not your mate, I say. I think you might be able to guess why.
I played drunker than I am during the speech. I'm not actually all that drunk. Plus, the coke has sharpened me. My mind feels very clear now, like someone's turned on a big bright spotlight in my brain. Lots of stuff is suddenly lit up, making sense. This is the last time anyone plays me for the fool.
Up until about 2 this afternoon, I was your mate, I tell him.
But not now. Not any longer.
What are you talking about? Will asks. He's starting to sound a bit unsure of himself.
Yeah, I think.
you're right to be scared. I could see him looking at me the whole way through that speech, wondering what the fuck I was doing. Wondering what I was going to say next, tell all his guests about him. I hope he was shitting himself. I wish I'd gone the whole hog in my speech, told them everything. But I chickened out. Like I chickened out all those years ago, when I should have gone to the teachers too, backed up whichever kid it was that sneaked on us, told them exactly what we had done. They wouldn't have been able to ignore two of us, would they? But I couldn't do it then, and I couldn't do it in the speech. Because I'm a fucking coward. This is the next best thing. I had an interesting chat with Piers earlier, I say. Very educational. I see Will swallow. Look, he says carefully, his tone very reasonable, man to man. It only makes me more angry. I don't know what Piers said to you, but you fucked me over, I say. Piers didn't actually need to say all that much. I worked it out for myself. Yeah, me. Stupid Jono. Must try harder. You couldn't have me there, could you? Too much of a liability. Reminding you of what you once were. What you did. Will grimaces. Jono, mate, you and me, I say. See, it was meant to be you and me, sticking up for each other, always. Us against the world, that's what you said. Especially after what we'd done, what we knew about each other. I had your back, you had mine. That's how I thought it was. It is, Jono. You're my best man. Can I tell you something? I say. The whole whiskey business? Oh, yeah, Will says quickly, eagerly. Hellraiser. He's remembered it this time. See, there you go. You're doing so well for yourself. No need for all this bitterness. Nah, I cut him off again. See, it doesn't exist. What are you talking about? Those bottles you've given us are fakes. I shrug, even though he can't see me. It's some single malt from the supermarket, decanted into plain bottles. Got my mate Alan to make up labels for me. Jono, what? I mean, I did actually think I could do it at the beginning. That's what makes it so tragic. It's why I got Alan to mock the design up at first, to see how it might look. But do you know how hard it is to launch a whiskey brand these days? Unless you're David Beckham, or you have rich parents to bankroll you, or connections with important people. I have none of that. I never did. All the other boys at Trev's knew it. I know some of them called me a pikey behind my back. But what we had, I thought that was solid. Will shifting on the ground, trying to sit up. I'm not going to help him. Jono, mate, Jesus. Yeah, oh, and I didn't leave the wilderness retreat to set up the whiskey brand. How pathetic is this? Wait for it. I got fired for being stoned on the job. Like a teenager. This fat bloke on a team bonding course. I let him go down too fast on the ab sail and he broke an ankle. And do you know why I was stoned? Why? He asks, wary. Because I have to smoke it to get by. Because it's the only thing that helps me forget. See, it feels like my whole life stopped at that point, all those years ago. It's like nothing good has happened since. The one good thing that's happened to me in the years after Trev's was that shot at the TV show. And you took it away from me. I pause, take a deep breath, prepared to say what I finally come to realise after nearly 20 years. But it's not like that for you, is it? It's like the past doesn't affect you. It didn't matter to you at all. You carry on taking what you need, and you always get away with it.
Hannah, the plus one. The four ushers explode back into the marquee. Peter Ramsay does a knee slide across the laminate, nearly crashing into the table bearing the magnificent wedding cake. I see Duncan leap onto Angus's back, his arm making a tight headlock around his neck so his face begins to turn purple. Angus staggers, half laughing, half gasping for breath. Then Femi jumps on top of both of them and they collapse in a tangled heap of limbs. They're pumped up, excited by their stunt, I suppose, carrying Will out of the marquee like that.
"To the bar, boys," Duncan roars, leaping to his feet. "Time to raise hell."
The rest of the guests follow them, taking this as their cue, laughing and chattering. I stay sitting in my seat. Most seem thrilled, titillated, by the speech and the spectacle that came after it, but I can't say I feel the same. Though Will was smiling, there was a disturbing undertone about it all. The blindfold, tying his hands and feet like that,